This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're focusing on water. You'll hear some disturbing news from an NYC investigative reporter.
Here lies the problem, how much we don't know about water tanks.
Katie Kiefer reports on water woes in the heartland.
Their water is heavily polluted with nitrates, which are coming from agricultural chemical applications on fields and running off into their water table.
And we'll check in with Dave Arnold, who's about to open a new bar that will serve some pretty fancy H2O.
It is hardcore.
So pour up a tall glass of ice water and be refreshed by this week's episode of Meat in 3, available on heritageradionetwork.org, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
And the other half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Greg, great to hear from you.
Darren, as always, congratulations on having your baby girl.
Yes, we're so excited. Josephine is 5 weeks old today, and she has been making the rounds at all the L.A. restaurants. In fact, we stopped by Friedman's, who's on today's show, for a big brisket dinner, which is hands down one of the best, if not the best, large format option in L.A. right now.
Amazing. And we have Bodega from Brooklyn, who's actually heading out to hit some West Coast dates later this summer. They'll be live in studio talking about pretentiousness and why that's a positive thing in their new record, Endless Scroll.
And before we kick off today's show, we want to take a moment to pay tribute and honor Anthony Bourdain, who's passing this week, shocked not just the culinary world, but everyone beyond. I know personally, Kitchen Confidential, like many others, really inspired me and put me on the track to work in food and to show that showing up every day for work, day in, day out, year in, year out, is really important.
Darren, I couldn't have said it better myself. You will be missed. And please, if you know of anyone who is facing depression or needs a helping hand, or just even someone that you love that you think is going through a hard time, reach out to them and have that hard conversation. It's a shame to think that this could have been prevented.
It is. It's really tough, and it's a big thing, especially working in kitchens or working in media or being average, normal job or anything. You know, depression can be with anyone. I know that I've dealt with it a lot throughout my life, and it's not something to be ashamed of, but it is something that people should talk about and embrace. So, you know, don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to talk to people. And, you know, if you notice that someone might be feeling down, reach out. You know, a little kindness, a little empathy goes a long way, especially in this day and age.
I agree. Well, I love you, buddy.
Love you too, bud. All right, let's get into the show. Here we go. We got a song from Bodega here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
This is new Bodega song.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are sitting in the beautiful Friedman's in Los Angeles. I feel like I've stepped into a different era in the best way possible. We're sitting here with Jonah Friedman, owner, designer, and operator, and Liz Johnson, executive chef. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Congratulations first.
Thank you.
For the best new chef. Nod, we'll get to the details a little bit later, but how awesome is that?
It's pretty crazy. It's a pretty humbling experience to be included in the lineup, so.
And be part of that 300-person legacy.
Yeah.
So for those who are unfamiliar with Friedman's and have never been, and they may have not been because you've only been open for a few months, how would you describe it?
I think the sort of elevator pitch for Friedman's is like a new school Jewish deli and bar with an old school flair. You know?
And a little bit of flair because you wanted to do something different and modern, or you thought that there was something that deli had not been explored?
Well, I think we've paired sort of a like an old school, sort of like older established restaurant aesthetic with a menu that reads a little bit more contemporary, like it's Jewish deli food, but for a more contemporary palate.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's go back a little bit. Where were you guys both born? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Toronto.
I'm from upstate New York. I'm from Schenectady.
Was deli food a big part of your upbringing, or was it something you came to later in life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Jewish, grew up in Toronto, and there's quite a large Jewish population in Toronto.
Yep.
And I think probably when I was younger, there was a more vibrant, I mean, like most places in America, there used to be a more vibrant deli scene.
I mean, it's a hard business to run.
It is, yeah. It's all protein heavy.
It's right? All protein, and there's always this expectation of giving the customer a little something extra. You know, extra pickles, extra bread,
yeah,
larger sandwiches, things like that.
Yeah.
But you grew up with it, and there is, my dad's from Montreal, so I'm very familiar with the Montreal bagel,
yeah.
But I know that there's a Toronto-style bagel as well.
Yeah, we've sort of dubbed, like, there's this bakery called Greif's in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
and they're 100-plus years in business, and at this point, I think for a long time, there was always a debate between the Toronto bagel and the Montreal bagel in Toronto. And at this point, Greif's has kind of taken over the market a little bit.
Sure.
To the point where one could argue that that's the Toronto-style bagel. I have talked to people from Toronto, and they're like, oh, I read that Friedman's has a Toronto-style bagel. I'm like, that doesn't exist.
So, it doesn't exist.
No. It's not like an actual thing, but we've sort of made it
sure.
into one. Because we used the Greif's recipe, or like the idea of the Greif's bagel as the jumping-off point, and then went from there and figured out the way we could do, you know, our own style of bagel.
Gotcha. And Liz, did you grow up with Jewish food at all, or any deli in upstate New York?
No, not whatsoever.
No?
No. I mean, my dad's from Brooklyn, but I didn't really grow up with that in upstate New York.
Was there a lot of Jewish food in upstate New York?
No, it's like red sauce Italian.
Yeah, yeah. It's more of that. For those who are sort of unfamiliar with, like, the Jewish deli and, like, the restaurant like that, like, what is the importance of, like a Jewish deli place in a community or, like, to people? And something that you both want to bring from a food point of view and from maybe more of an experiential point of view in creating the restaurant?
Sure. I think from an experience point of view, in terms of, like, the dining experience, the idea of sort of an all-day restaurant and a place that is, you know, a restaurant for the community, a restaurant that feels, you know, like you belong, a restaurant that feels like home, that you feel comfortable in. That to me is sort of where, you know, deli and diner have a lot of crossover for me. You know, to me a deli is almost just like a Jewish diner.
Sure.
And that's kind of the way I was thinking about it when we approached opening Friedman's. And, you know, the idea that you could come for lunch, come back for sort of a more formal dinner, you know, maybe like even a business dinner, and then come back later in the night again to just hang out at the bar. We've had people do that, and it's when people like when people do use the space in that way that I kind of get really excited that it seems like they really get what we're going for. And yeah, I think that's kind of what the idea of the deli means. It's just like a meeting place in a way.
Now, I know that you got started in restaurants a little bit later in life, or going to restaurants only compared because, Liz, you started cooking at 15.
Yes.
What drew you to restaurants at such an early age?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure. There's nobody in my family who has worked in the restaurant industry before, so I can't really explain what drew me to it, but I've never held a job that wasn't in the kitchen.
Now, I know that also at an early age, yeah, you were a big metal fan.
Yeah,
big into music.
Still are.
Did you find any of the same parallels between sort of that heavy metal aesthetic, that sort of like no holds bar, just go after it in cooking?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the music is very aggressive, and you kind of have to immerse yourself into it to be a metalhead. And also, the kitchen is kind of the same way. It's like very gritty and, you know, noisy and busy, and it's just, to me, they make sense together. They're very similar.
Yeah, I mean, there's the thing that I like about the metal scene is that it's like hard to be a faker.
Yeah.
Like, you're all in, like, you really either know your stuff about metal mm-hmm. or you don't. And mm-hmm. I feel that's sort of the same way about cooking in kitchens, especially today.
Yes.
Where people are like, oh, I sort of know my way around, you know, these food blogs or things like that. It's like, yeah, but you don't actually know how to cook.
Yeah.
You went to go work for Jamie Bissonette.
Yes.
Who's also a fellow metalhead, hardcore guy.
He's like a hardcore guy.
He's more hardcore than metal. But one of the things that I read about you when you're working there is that you learned a lot about intuition. Can you describe that a little bit about what that means as a chef and how you've carried that from your essentially first big job through here?
Sure. I think when you graduate from culinary school, one of the things that they don't teach you is intuition. You learn how to read a recipe and follow instructions, but intuition comes from making mistakes and doing the same thing repeatedly until you can figure out what is missing, what a dish needs, what's going to make it taste better. And that only comes from working in an actual restaurant and being forced to prepare the same dish multiple times until you figure out what it is that it needs. I think that Jamie was very helpful because he gave me a lot of responsibility and freedom, I guess. So he just kind of forced me to learn it. It was like, there wasn't really an option.
Yeah. And did it sort of show you like the box and parameters that you could live in and then have the freedom within that? Or was it completely like wild and out there?
No, it definitely was like a box. I mean, yeah. It was like a young, when I worked for Jamie, I started working for him when I was 19. So he definitely didn't give me full responsibility, but there were, you know, times when he was like, I want to put a special on the menu. Here's what we have. Like, let's work with this, you and me. And it was those kind of instances that really taught me how to think and taste and season things.
I mean, that's amazing to be at that age and be trusted with any sort of public creativity.
Yeah,
Did that trust get ingrained in you, and did you allow that trust to be put onto other chefs that you worked with? Or do you still feel that you were like leading the cause, like when we were at Mimi's or anything like that? Like, how much of it is you feeling that you're leading the ship, and how much of it is working with the team?
I think everything is an open conversation with your team. That's the whole point, that you have people who work for you that, you know, you believe in them. And if it wasn't an open conversation, then nothing would be pushed, no boundaries would be pushed. That being said, I think especially at Mimi, it was hard for me to mm-hmm. allow people to have so much freedom because it was my first job where I was a chef and I wanted to control everything, you know. But the more I get into this, the more I realize that it is this give and take with your team. And if you choose the right people to work for you, then you're not going to have any issues.
Yeah. Now, I know that you're both East Coasters, or East Coast, Toronto, New York, Boston. Mm-hmm. I know you spent time at Noma as well. What brought you to L.A.? Because I feel like, and I am part of that exodus of East Coast to L.A., but what made you want to come to L.A.? What was it, wanting to open up a restaurant out here, or did you just come out here?
No, I specifically came out here to open this place.
When did you first have the idea then that you wanted to do a sort of like modern deli?
Actually, after I'd moved out already, I knew that I wanted to open a restaurant here. It wasn't until figuring out a space and talking, I think I had a number of sort of extensive conversations with my sister, who helped design the space.
Amanda, right?
Yes, exactly. And it was when, you know, talking to her, I think we were probably at Langer's one day.
Sure.
And
classic.
Classic. And we, you know, we were looking around and sort of saying, like, you know, what would this place look like if it didn't close at 4? And it was open till, you know, 9 o'clock at night, and the food was like a little bit more like dinner food.
Sure.
And there was a cocktail bar, and there were young people around us, and there was good music playing, and it like felt fun.
Yeah, because no one at Langer's who works there is under 65.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's when it started. And then we sort of said, like, wait, I would love this. And really, we just ended up building a restaurant that, like, we wanted to go to more than anything. And that, yeah.
Which is rare to say we're going to open a restaurant that we want to go to.
Right.
And then actually have it be successful that other people want to go to.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Which the same you could say about putting a menu together that you're like, this is the food that I want to cook. I hope people like it.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back, talk about the opening of the restaurant, and then, Liz, how you got involved and your approach to deli food without having a lifelong love for deli food. Because as a fellow Jew, I've been in great... I mean, like, I think I had, like, arugula and a pacifier when I was, like, 6. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Desires. trouble follow me wherever I go. There's trouble and water washing over me, drowning my thoughts of future desires. There's trouble and water washing over me, drowning my thoughts of future desires.
Back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here at Friedman's in Los Angeles with Jonah Friedman and Liz Johnson. So after you and your sister Amanda had the initial idea to open it, how long did it take to actually get it open? Because it's one thing to wax philosophically and dream over a number 19 at Langer's versus opening up a place that feels very thought out. You know, like I've seen young restaurants that are just like, oh yeah, you definitely just open this. You know, you walk into here and you, if you didn't know the story, you're like, this could be around for 50 years in the best way possible. You know, it's, you got the wallpaper, the dark wood, like just the vibe, the bar. So how long did it take? What was the process?
And that was the, you know, that astute, because that's the idea with it is, you know, our goal in designing the space and in concepting the space was we wanted a restaurant that felt like it had been there for 50 years and we wanted to open with an immediate establishment, you know, and taking that kind of approach to, I think, both the design and the menu, really, in terms of putting things on there that we think could, you know, continue inevitably.
Yeah, Liz, how did you get involved? Because you were in New York until pretty recently.
Yeah, I took about a month off before I came out here. One of the other owners was a friend of mine from before, and he reached out. He knew we were moving out here, so.
And just said, do you want to come? Let's talk about that, because did you like deli food? Because by the time you were in New York, you must have had some deli experiences.
Yeah, like I lived on Orchard Street, so I was eating at Katz's frequently.
Which, by the way, does not have, I have found, the best reputation for people who are in L.A. I've talked to other deli people, not fans of Katz's.
Yeah, really? But Langer's is questionable.
I mean, there are the sad secret of deli is that a lot of these places do not make their stuff in house.
That's a given.
Yeah,
it's pretty much a given. I think Katz's does make their stuff in house, but not everything. That being said, you know, we're fans of everyone for the most part. But how did you start approaching? There must have been some freedom then. Because if you didn't grow up with deli food, like if you put it on me to be like, all right, you're going to make a pastrami sandwich, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to make the best classic Reuben pastrami sandwich or like whitefish salad or pickles. Like I feel that you must have not had that heavy weight on your shoulders to follow the rules of like classic Jewish cuisine.
Yeah, no, I definitely felt there's certain items and ingredients that are integral to Jewish cuisine that I think are really cool, like half sours or, you know, all the smoked fish, all the sauerkrauts and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to be able to feature each of these in a way, you know, that I thought was appropriate. But some things I didn't really want to mess with too much, like the soup or the Reuben, because like that would just piss people off, frankly.
Right. Like if you come in and you're like, you can have your take on Reuben, and I've had the Reuben and it's awesome, but I definitely, it's a familiar, your take is still familiar
yeah.
as a Reuben. If you came in and you're like, oh, the we made the bread out of sauerkraut, and like
yeah,
it's like a
yeah.
cheese
like
sauce.
A, yeah, like a naturally leavened bread. Like, that just wouldn't work.
It's a gluten-free rye, you know? It's super nice.
But there were some things that I thought, for example, half sours. I'm not, like, I think it's a cool idea, but I don't want to really just eat a whole plate of it. I didn't want to write them off because it's unique to Jewish cuisine, and it doesn't exist anywhere else, so I felt that we had to feature them, but that was kind of the catalyst for, well, how can I use this ingredient in a way that's not just putting them on a pickle plate?
But it seems like, and it harkens back to sort of what you said, what you learned at Toro, is here's the box of Jewish deli, and here's the freedom that I have within that box.
Yeah.
So, how long did it take for you to come up with the menu? What was the process of it, like, in designing it and knowing that you wanted to have a bunch of the staples versus the new takes? And then, as a lifelong Jewish deli food guy, how did your input work on it as well?
I mean, I think it took a couple months to put together. There was definitely some stuff that didn't make the cut, or some things that just didn't really work. Like, for example, the whitefish cigar, something that's on the menu now, originally was like a whitefish donut, and that evolved.
Right.
But there was like multiple renditions before we came up with a menu that I felt good about. Yeah.
And how do you feel as a lifelong Jewish deli fan about being able to find some commonality in the food you grew up with, but also really ushering into this new era?
I think that's what was exciting for us to begin with, was to create, I mean, you look at a lot of the sort of new school Jewish delis, and you look at that trend across America, and everyone's just taking the aesthetic of the deli and modernizing it, you know, to a minimalist design, light, bright, and airy. They're serving the same deli food.
Right, they're just, the difference, the big twist is that they make it all in-house.
They make it all in-house, yeah, and it's like nicely, like it has like good like package design.
Sure.
That's your difference. And what we wanted to do is, you know, actually go quite classic with the space in terms of the design and aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
But then have a menu that felt a little bit more thoughtful, considered, contemporary, you know, of taking dishes that, you know, like Liz said, like lightly salted cucumbers are not the most interesting thing in the world.
Sure.
But make them into a salad with, you know, fennel, nasturtium, avocado, they really start to shine.
Right.
So I think to kind of look at deli food and say, you know, some of this is great, some of this, frankly, could use a little help.
Sure.
And then figuring out where that help, you know, could go was a really exciting prospect.
I mean, it feels to me with the hours, the bar, the different types of food, there's a whole experience that's going on here with the food. And one of the things I noticed when I was here the other week is that music also plays a big part in it. Like, the soundtrack is not at all what you would expect into that. And can you guys talk a little bit about that curation of music, but also creating the whole vibe from when people walk in?
Right. I mean, I think part of it is creating a, you know, the idea of a Jewish deli that appeals to a younger generation.
Right.
So obviously, you know, that starts with, you know, the idea of a total dining experience is, you know, starts with visuals, starts with music, you know, a vibe in space. You know, who works there? How are they talking to you? Do they feel like people, or are they just, you know, robotic waiters? And all of those things, you know, had to be considered in terms of the way in which we wanted to, you know, appeal to people like me, like my sister, and like Liz. Like, where do we want to eat, and how do we want the space to be? How do we want people to interact with us? So obviously, yeah, music became a big part of it. A lot of it is just music that we listen to. Our GM Michael, he plays a lot of stuff. And my college roommate, who also runs our bar, Rob, he has curated kind of a massive list of Friedman selects for us as well.
Any metal on the playlist?
Late night sometimes.
Late night?
Judas Priest.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not the heavier Norwegian.
Well, sometimes, sometimes, in between services, but not when customers are here.
The problem is the space isn't, like, super geared for it.
Yeah.
I actually find that hip-hop ends up sounding better in the space.
I mean, I feel like hip-hop is the main... If you open up a strip mall...
Yeah.
Strip mall, yeah. Restaurant,
yeah.
That's hip.
Exactly.
Hip-hop's always on
right.
The stereo.
Exactly.
Now, I want to get
a lot of Drake.
A lot of Drake. Drake, I mean, it's yeah. What can you do?
It's good restaurant music, honestly.
I feel like he has a restaurant setup where he just, like, you know how they have, like, the car test for music?
Yeah.
He probably just has, like, a small strip mall restaurant where he's like, does this song sound good?
Right.
It'll play across all of LA.
Right, exactly.
Now, Liz, with the Best New Chef award that you won, did you have any idea that it was coming? Did you have any idea that, like, the food that you were doing or how to do it or was gonna land you this accolade?
I mean, you never really expect to win something like that. I feel like when Jordana showed up, it was kind of a total surprise. But I think once she came to eat, we knew why she was here, and it was like, okay, this is happening. This is gonna happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely a big shock for me.
And how do you feel about it? I mean, it's been about a week, now?
It was last Monday. It's great. Yeah, I feel, you know, I've been reading those awards since I was a young cook, and to be a part of that family is kind of crazy. It's still surreal to me.
Well, I mean, it's totally awesome and totally well-deserved. So, as Friedman enters, still continuing essentially its first year in business, where do you see its place in the LA dining landscape? Where do you see the future of the restaurant? You know, how do you continue to see its evolution? Because obviously this is something that's going to start, you're going to add different food, you're going to have different experiences. Where do you both see it going in the next year, the next 5 years?
I really want to build our late night a little bit more, honestly. We have been doing these sort of DJ nights called Friends and Friedman's on Thursdays, and that's when we do the Pastrami Crunchwrap Supreme, and we also have two DJs who are set up on that high table in the restaurant, and they just spin records, and, you know, the bar stays open until 2 a.m., because we have a license to go until 2 a.m.
Which is awesome
and so rare. And especially, like, pair that with full liquor, it's a really exciting opportunity.
Yeah,
and
let me just say that as I'm staring at the full bar, I don't know of any other deli on either coast that has a full bar like you guys do.
Right, yeah.
And also someone who knows that actually wield the liquor behind it and isn't just like some, like, liquor and splash or something.
Right. No, yeah, it's a full, I mean, we do classics and martinis, and that's the focus of our menu.
I mean, Reuben and a martini sounds pretty good to me.
Exactly.
And then for the food, I mean, how do you go deeper into Jewish menu? Do you start looking at, like, kreplach and cholent and, like, those sort of, like, other Jewish staples that are maybe not well known, updating them, or do you sort of stick within the whole, like, deli menu?
I think for us right now, it's in our best interest just to really focus on controlling the quality as we get busier. I'm not really looking to expand too much more. I feel like we've done a good job of pushing what we can do with Jewish food, but at a certain point, you've got to know where to draw the line. And I don't know if, like, kreplach, for example, was something we had talked about in the beginning, but it's not really like a Jewish deli thing.
No.
To me, that's something you eat at your house.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're just trying to knock what we're doing out of the park and just nail it, yeah.
I mean, and you offer lunch, a different lunch menu, a different brunch menu, and a dinner, and for the size of the space, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to thank you both for your time. Congratulations again. Super excited that this is literally down the house for me, and I can just literally roll the stroller on my way. Where can people find you online in real life? Where can they get the information?
Freemansla.com
mm-hmm.
and Friedman's_LA on Instagram.
Great.
I think we use Instagram more than we use anything else. So like any announcements that we have, anytime we do a late night, it's always on Instagram.
Good gram game?
Okay, gram game. Like, you know, we're working on it.
It's good. It's a lot. To be honest, it's a full-time job where you're like, do I know someone who's really good at the gram that can just hang out?
Right.
Well, listen, thank you so much. Yeah. Appreciate taking the time, and we'll be seeing you quite often.
Awesome.
We have another song from the archives, and then we have a live performance in studio here on Heritage Radio Network on Snacky Tunes. Enjoy.
We sacrifice.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margaux and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used, and then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for an extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Bodega live in studio. Good to see all of you. Just came from Northside Fest. How was that?
Playing on Bedford.
Yeah, it's like they shut down
between
the whole thing.
Yeah, the Apple Store and Duane Reade. It's kind of perfect, actually, for us.
Yeah, it's like a dream come true to sit right in the center of consumerism and play about anti-capitalism.
Yeah.
Do you think that they heard the message?
No.
Someone like very upset that they had to be late to their genius bar. Is that because you were playing songs?
They were like walking by and like filming us with their iPhones, you know, so they could Snapchat later. But no one, you know.
Can't knock the hustle when Bedford's making capital.
You used to be called Bodega Bay, and nothing that this band does is unintentional. So I'm curious why you dropped the Bay part but kept the name, and what the new name and the songs you write couldn't be done under the old moniker.
Well, the simple answer is that this is a totally different band. Me and Nikki were in Bodega Bay, but philosophically it's kind of trying to do something similar, but the sound is totally different. So, you know, it's a more streamlined sound, so it's got a streamlined name.
But why keep part of the name and not just do a whole new thing?
Because I wanted people to realize the philosophical connection between Bodega Bay. I thought the kind of songwriting and the kind of prankster thing that we had set up, I didn't want to let go of that. And, you know, I play shows around town as Bodega Ben, and I kind of like, that became my identity. I didn't want to lose that, you know.
How has the philosophy evolved from the last project under Bodega Ben into just Bodega?
Well, Bodega Bay was kind of rock music about rock music. Yeah, we were kind of critiquing and celebrating the rock apparatus, and Bodega does something similar, but it's a little bit more autobiographical now. So I'd say we turn that same lens, instead of simply on songwriting tropes or performance tropes, we turn them on our daily lives. So it's a little bit more, not that Bodega Bay didn't do that to a certain extent, but there's...
I think this particular album is focusing on like our documentary of living our lives through the screen. You get a lot of more different imagery of computers than the last band had, like none of that really.
So you're looking more inward with this project as opposed to the previous one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Bodega Bay, I would say it was looking inward as well. I mean, it was kind of about the... Bodega Bay started as the realization of the sort of existential guilt I had as a lifelong rock fan, of waking up being like, wait, I hate rock music, I hate rock culture, it's so stupid, it's so superficial, its relation to capitalism, its relation to just the superficial aspects of consumer society, and like... all the utopian things about rock music, all you know, how inspiring it can be and being a part of something genuinely DIY, everything good, the ecstatic things about performance, everything good about it was sort of outweighed by all the negative things. So Bodega Bay was kind of in this Hegelian synthesis of putting the celebration against the critique. Sorry, what was the question?
No, you were great. Right. Just essentially how the philosophy is now evolved in Bodega and what's changed.
Right. Well, I feel like I kind of said everything I wanted to say about that particular subject. So Bodega, our current subject right now is kind of how social media affects people's lives. You know, there are some more personal songs on the record. There's like a song about my mom. There's a song about my ex-girlfriend. There's a song about one of my friends who passed away. So... you know, I we're almost like a more traditional band now. I'm singing the blues essentially, but I don't know. I think if anyone were, you know, of the 100 people that will hear the Bodega album, if only one of them heard the Bodega Bay album, they would see that it's a sequel. It's you know, there are references back to it. And, you know, I see it as a, you know, following the same lineage in a way.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
We're going to play the first track off our upcoming record. It's called How Did This Happen?
Here we go, Bodega, live on Snacky Tunes.
This is New Bodega Song.
Pretentiousness and how that's a positive thing. How does that feed into the recording process, and what did that go into writing this record?
Well, even though we just basically recorded the whole record live to tape, we went in with an extreme amount of intention. There was a super long pre-production process, and nothing on the sound is not meant to be there. You know, it's a very minimal record. It's not a very guitar heavy record. All there is just a floor tom and a snare, a separate hi-hat sometimes, and two guitars playing very specific kind of pointless parts. It's like sound sculpture in a way. So, you know, what's pretentious about it in the best sense of the word is that it's, you know, it's extremely thought out. It's artificial.
Did you start with more? I mean, obviously there's bass in there as well. Did you start with more on the record and then strip things out? Or did you just go in with almost what we see in this room?
It's pretty much exactly what you see in this room. I think a lot of the songwriting process is you write, for me at least, I like to write really melodic kind of songs with, you know, big major chord, kind of like the most obvious pop rock kind of things. And then you get really good melodies out of that. But then when you perform the song, then you take away that guitar part. That's the first thing. And then you just build up the rhythm section, get an interesting groove going, a good bass line, and then you treat the guitars more texturally.
And we had Madison do a bunch of demos for us and drilling and everything like that, and that's where we hashed out everything right before we went into the actual recording process. Like, we knew this is the part you're going to play, and this is, you know, this is exactly what's going to happen.
And after you listened, did you pull even more out, or was it just you knew before you hit record, or just as more continue to get stripped out?
During the demos? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it shaped a lot of new guitar parts and stripping down, definitely. Yeah, switching up the drums so it's not, like, intrusive.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play Margot, one of my songs.
I touch myself while staring at your chat text box.
Between UK and European tours, do you think the message that you are bringing to the forefront works universally, or is it mostly just American fed?
The internet is universal. I think that's how people listen to us and have heard about us, you know, our songs streaming on different like platforms and online articles and things like that. So I think everyone kind of comes at it in a similar fashion.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Brexit going on and the UK people definitely relate. But, I mean, Bodega, I don't want to pigeonhole us. We're not going to be just a band that only sings about Web 2.0. You know, our mantra is the best critique is self-critique. Our songs are all about pointing out our own moral hypocrisies, and I think a lot of people can relate. You know, we're in a very self-aware epoch right now, and we're just kind of soundtracking that.
As your own kind of like radical honesty and personal truth evolve, do the songs take on different meanings, or once you kind of get past the issue you're dealing with in a song, does the song go away or just become a time capsule?
It's a really good question, actually. One song that has changed a lot for me, we have this song called Jack and Titanic. When I first wrote it and we first started playing it, I saw it as pure satire, like a very silly kind of... It was theoretical, and I was taking the piss out of a certain male masculinity. But then I really reflected on it. It was actually through a conversation with Austin. We were making the record. He kind of made me realize that he's like, I think, Ben, what you're singing in these lines, you really mean. And I realized I did mean them. And some of the come-ons in particular were me coming on to Nikki in a way when I was sort of courting her. And I wrote that song right at the beginning of our relationship. And I realized the sort of toxic masculinity in it is actually my own, which actually made the song more interesting. And there's a certain kind of nostalgia in the song too, about, you know, I was really thinking of the movies that taught me what it is to be a man. I'm saying man in quotes, which are Jackie Chan movies, James Bond movies. You know, I still to this day have this fantasy of sitting down at a blackjack table with a beautiful girl on my arms, smoking a cigar and kind of like, you know, being... knowing 20 languages and just being cool as a cucumber, and that's in Jack and Titanic, I think.
We want to thank you for coming by today. Where can people hear the record, watch your videos, which are incredible, by the way? They're really awesome. Where can people find you, check out your upcoming tour dates?
We have a Tumblr for Bodega Amazing. NYC Tumblr, which where you can find all the dates, which has Ben has done a great job of like categorizing all the past shows and future ones, and he also has like all the, like, he has everything on there.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram and all those other kind of things that you would expect a band to have.
And that we sing about.
Yeah. Spotify. That, you know, if you Google band, Bodega New York City Band, you'll probably be able
Bodega
to find
BK.
Us.
Bodega BK.
Yeah.
Even better. Coming IRL. What's the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
Warhol.
Warhol. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes.
Cool.
Go.
Philosophy of a war. This is philosophy of a war. And he said the best artist was businessman. And the best businessman is a cobalt killer. So it follows that the best artists are killers too.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.